Hi, everyone. In this lecture, I'm going to cover epidemiological concepts that you may encounter on the board exam. These concepts may be part of the question stem, or they may be the question itself. So hopefully you'll find this useful. I have no disclosures relevant to this talk. In this talk, we're going to cover study designs, incidence and prevalence, assessment of risk in epidemiological studies, a short primer on confidence intervals and number needed to treat, an overview of sensitivity, specificity, negative predictive value, and positive predictive value, and we're going to end with a few words on bias and confounding. So let's start with study designs. A familiar design is the experimental design, often referred to as the randomized trial, where groups are often allocated to an intervention arm or arms and to a control arm. This allocation should ideally be random to minimize bias. The intervention is often masked or blinded to participants and to investigators, and this usually means it's double masked, to further diminish the risk of introducing bias. These studies, when designed correctly, are considered to be the gold standard, but they are labor and cost intensive. The aim of observational studies, often referred to as cohort studies, is to assess the impact of an exposure on a particular outcome or outcomes. Exposed and non-exposed persons are followed, and the disease outcome of interest is assessed in both groups to determine if the exposure modified the risk of the disease. Investigators must be careful about the potential for bias in these studies. There's the potential for selection biases, because participants are not randomly allocated. And there's also the potential for information biases depending on how the exposure and outcome are measured. Usually, these studies tend to require a significant follow-up period, so the resource requirements may be significant as well. Case control studies are often used in outbreaks. This is really important for the boards. In these studies, investigators find a group of people with the disease and a group without the disease, and they compare the exposures to try to identify risk factors for that particular disease. These studies are usually retrospective, and they tend to be efficient. However, they are fraught with potential biases, so one must be very careful when interpreting the results. These studies may suggest an association between an exposure and an outcome, but because of the biases and their limitations, it's usually not often possible to infer causation from a case control study. So let's apply what we talked about just now using the following examples. First, you're an EIS officer and you're trying to determine what caused 35 people to experience fever and severe hemorrhagic complications after returning from a Caribbean cruise. In this example, there is an outbreak of a hemorrhagic illness, that is the disease outcome, and you're trying to figure out what caused it, that is the exposure. Of course, the most appropriate study design in this case is going to be the case control study. You would take as cases persons with the hemorrhagic illness, and you would choose a group of controls from the passengers on the same cruise who did not have the illness. You would then try to determine which exposure led to that illness. In the second example, you're trying to get a novel influenza vaccine approved by the FDA. The only study design that would allow you to obtain FDA approval really is an experimental design, a randomized controlled trial where one group is given the vaccine and another group is given a placebo or a different vaccine. The outcome, usually influenza or influenza-like illness, is then measured in both groups and a determination is made whether the vaccine is efficacious. In the third example, you're trying to determine whether hormonal contraception increases your risk of HIV seroconversion. For this case, all three study designs are possible. For example, you could randomize women to the HC group and to the placebo group and follow them to see if the HC group is more likely to seroconvert. But there are a lot of reasons why it would be difficult, and a big one being ethical reasons. One could also perform a case control study. Take women with HIV cases and a group of women without HIV controls and see if HC use, which is the exposure, was more common in women who are HIV infected. The case control study design is fine, but is likely to be highly biased. If you have the resources, probably the most feasible study design in this situation, given the ethical considerations of an experimental study design, may be the cohort or observational study. You recruit a group of reproductive age women, some will be on HC and some will not, and you follow them for a specified period of time and compare the incidence rates of HIV in both groups. Again, you still have the potential for biases, but this type of study design is less prone to bias than the case control study design. Now let's focus on our attention on two important measures of disease activity. These can apply to both infectious and non-infectious diseases. So we're going to focus here on infections. Incidence is a measure of new infections occurring during a specified period of time in a population at risk for developing that infection. Incidence is a measure of events in a population and is therefore a measure of risk. Prevalence, on the other hand, is the number of existing infections in a population at a given time. These infections may have been around for a long time, or they may be new infections. As a result, prevalence is not a measure of risk. Prevalence is equal to the incidence times the duration of disease. So let's apply what we talked about just now using this example. In a population that includes persons with HIV who exhibit high medication adherence, what would be the impact of ART on HIV incidence and prevalence over a 10-year period of time? Incidence measures new HIV infections during the 10-year period of time in this population. We know that ART decreases the risk of HIV transmission. Assuming no other factors at play, the incidence of HIV should decrease in this population over these 10 years. In other words, this population's risk for new HIV infections should decrease. Again, we're assuming no other factors at play. The prevalence measures all HIV infections in this population during these 10 years. Although the number of new HIV infections may decrease, more people with HIV may live a longer period of time when using ART. So it's possible that the prevalence may increase over these 10 years. I think this example highlights the difference between incidence and prevalence. Now let's focus on measures of risk. The relative risk is defined as the incidence of the disease in those who are exposed, divided by the incidence in those who are not exposed. As such, if the relative risk is 1, there is no association between the exposure and the disease. If the relative risk is greater than 1, then the exposure increased the disease risk. And if the relative risk is less than 1, the exposure decreased the disease risk. The relative risk is a common measure used to calculate risk in prospective studies. For example, in a study assessing risk factors for HIV incidence, injection drug use had a relative risk of 5, while condom use had a relative risk of 0.4. The interpretation of the relative risk in this example would be, compared to persons who did not inject drugs, persons who injected drugs had a 5-fold increased risk of acquiring HIV. Compared to persons who did not use condoms, persons who used condoms had a 60% reduced risk of acquiring HIV. A specific type of relative risk is the hazard ratio, which is an instantaneous measure of risk. That is, it's a risk that occurs at a particular point in time. And that is usually used in prospective time-to-event studies. For example, early in the 1980s, there were several prospective cohort studies established to try and determine the time and risks involved in the progression from HIV to AIDS. For these questions, time-to-event models were used to assess risks, and hazard ratios were reported. Hazard ratios are interpreted the same way as relative risks. The odds of a disease are defined as the probability that disease developed divided by the probability that it did not develop. There is a difference between risks and odds. Let's take a very practical example. Someone flips a coin 10 times and gets heads 4 times and tails 6 times. The odds of getting heads is 4 out of 6 or 0.7, the number of times one gets heads divided by the number of times one does not get heads. The risk of getting heads is 4 out of 10, or 0.4, the number of times one gets heads divided by the total of number of times one was at risk of getting heads. That is, the total of number of times that one flipped the coin. As you can see, the denominator for odds is different than the denominator for risk. The odds ratio in a cohort study is defined as the ratio of odds of the disease occurring in those exposed to the odds of disease occurring in those not exposed. The odds ratio in a case control study is defined as the ratio of the odds that the cases were exposed to the odds that the controls were exposed. The interpretation of the odds ratio is similar to that of the relative risk, as can be seen on the slide. Let's apply what we talked about just now using this example. In a population of 1,000 people, 400 were having unprotected sex. Infection Y occurred in 100 of the 400 who were having unprotected sex, and in 5 of the 600 who were not. The relative risk is calculated as the risk of infection Y occurring in those who are exposed through unprotected sex, which is 100, those with infection Y who are having unprotected sex, over 400, the total number of persons having unprotected sex, divided by the risk of infection Y occurring in those who are not having unprotected sex. 5, those with infection Y who are not having unprotected sex, divided by 600, total number of persons not having unprotected sex. Those having unprotected sex had a 31.3-fold increased risk of developing infection Y. The odds ratio, or relative odds, is calculated as the odds of infection Y occurring in those who are exposed through unprotected sex divided by the odds of infection Y occurring in those who are not having unprotected sex. Those having unprotected sex had a 41.3-fold increased odds of developing infection Y. Again, this example highlights the difference between risks and odds. Risks and odds approximate each other when the outcome is rare. For example, you flip a coin 100 times and you get one heads and 99 tails. Calculate the odds of getting heads, and that's 1 out of 99. Calculate the risks of getting heads, that's 1 out of 100. As you can see in this example, the odds approximate the risks because the outcome of interest is rare. So now you're a public health practitioner and you're asked to spend money wisely to decrease the incidence of a serious infection. If I were to give you the relative risks of various risk factors for that infection, it would be hard for you to know how best to spend the money. What you need to know in order to spend your money wisely is the attributable risk, which is the proportion of disease incidence that can be attributed to a specific exposure. It is defined as the incidence in the exposed minus the incidence in the non-exposed. So let's go directly to an example, and this will clarify a really important concept in public health. So a new deadly fungal infection is described with a mortality rate of 30%. You're given $1 million to spend on prevention for this fungal infection in your state. Persons with exposure A have a relative risk of 16 for getting infected, very high risk. Persons with exposure B have a relative risk of 2 for getting infected, much less. Based on these relative risks, a knee-jerk response would be to spend your money on preventing exposure A. But is that really wise? Let's find out a little bit more about these exposures. So now, I'm going to tell you that exposure A is spelunking and exposure B is gardening. Are you going to change your spending plan? Even though the relative risk of spelunking is far more than gardening, most of the cases in your state are likely the result of gardening because a lot more people garden than spelunk. As such, the attributable risk of gardening is much greater than spelunking, as can be seen in the table. Spelunking accounts for 30 cases per million, whereas gardening accounts for 320 cases per million. So this example clearly highlights the difference in information that is provided by a relative risk versus an attributable risk. And in public health decisions, you often need information about attributable risk to make wise decisions. A very important concept is that of a confidence interval. These intervals are used to indicate the reliability of a point estimate. In other words, they are used to inform us about the degree of uncertainty surrounding a point estimate. The wider the confidence limit, the more uncertainty exists. Confidence limits are related to two very important factors. They are directly related to the standard deviation of the measurement. As the standard deviation of the measurement increases, the confidence limits increase, and as such, the certainty decreases. For example, if you're using a scale that is not very accurate, so the difference between measurements on the same person are large, the standard deviation is going to be large. Consequently, the use of the scale will yield the point estimate with very wide confidence limits because the uncertainty is very large. The second thing that confidence limits are related to, they are indirectly related to the sample size. The larger the sample size, the smaller the confidence interval, or the narrower the confidence interval. That's why a study with a large sample size tends to provide narrow confidence intervals. In other words, they tend to provide more precise estimate. The most common type of confidence interval that is calculated in biomedical studies is the 95% confidence interval. In simple terms, a 95% confidence interval means if you were to repeat this experiment many times, in 95% of the time, your results will fall within the range of that confidence interval. For example, a study of 3,500 commercial sex workers found a prevalence of gonorrhea of 8.9%. The 95% confidence interval ranged from 8.1% to 9.4%. The interpretation of this would be if one were to repeat the study many times over, there's a 95% likelihood that our prevalence estimate for gonorrhea will fall somewhere within the range of 8.1 to 9.4%. So now match each scenario to the more likely prevalence point estimate and confidence interval. In scenario one, we test 100 people in the population for HIV. In scenario two, we test 3,500 people in the population for HIV. Assuming we're using the same methods to detect HIV, which scenario would yield a more precise estimate? That is, which scenario would yield a narrower confidence interval? Of course, the scenario with the larger sample size. So scenario two, which has the larger sample size, would best match answer A, where the confidence limits are more narrow. The number needed to treat is also a very important concept in infectious diseases. We often have to answer questions like, how many infants need to be vaccinated to prevent one case of rotavirus infection? How many exposed persons need to be given prophylactic antibiotic therapy to prevent one case of meningitis, etc.? These concepts often are at the heart of trying to assess the cost efficiency of an intervention. The number needed to treat is defined as 1 over the rate in the untreated group minus the rate in the treated group. So, for example, an RCT for a new Ebola vaccine demonstrated that the mortality rate in the experimental group is 20%, while the mortality rate in the control group is 85%. How many people do we need to vaccinate to prevent one death from Ebola? Based on the number needed to treat formula, 1.5 persons need to be vaccinated to prevent one death from Ebola. This, needless to say, would be an amazing vaccine. Some very important concepts that are used in diagnostic testing and beyond are concepts of sensitivity, specificity, positive predictive value, and negative predictive value. Sensitivity is the ability to test to correctly identify those. Sorry, I'm going to start over again for this slide. I apologize. Some very important concepts that are used in diagnostic testing and beyond are the concepts of sensitivity, specificity, positive predictive value, and negative predictive value. Sensitivity is the ability of a test to correctly identify those who have a disease. Specificity is the ability of a test to correctly identify those who don't have a disease. Positive predictive value is the proportion who test positive and actually have the disease. Negative predictive value is the proportion who test negative and don't have the disease. If one were to look at a 2x2 table, as on the slide, you could easily define these parameters based on occurrence of true positives, true negatives, false positives, and false negative test results. A very important point to remember is that sensitivity and specificity are independent of prevalence, while positive predictive value and negative predictive value depend on prevalence. In other words, they are dependent on the pretest probability of the condition. So, for example, the glycoprotein G-based antibody tests for the detection of HSV2 antibodies have a sensitivity of 99% and a specificity of 98.5%. We plan to test two populations, 1,000 commercial sex workers, and the second population is 1,000 nuns confined to a convent. In which population will the tests have a higher sensitivity, specificity, positive predictive value, or negative predictive value? So, the sensitivity and specificity are independent of prevalence of disease. As such, the sensitivity and specificity of these tests will be the same in both populations. Now, population A likely has a higher prevalence of HSV2 compared to population B. As such, the positive predictive value of the test will be much higher in population A, and the negative predictive value will be higher in population B. Remember, there are no diagnostic tests that have 100% sensitivity and 100% specificity. As such, if your pretest probability, in other words, the prevalence, for a condition is low, and if you test for that condition, the probability that a positive test result is a true positive will likely be low, even when the specificity of the test is relatively high. If you're not going to believe a positive test result because the patient is really not at risk for that condition, don't order the test. For example, somebody who's never had sex, who is asymptomatic and requests HSV2 serological testing, should not be tested, because if the test result comes back as positive, it is very likely to be a false positive test result. So we're going to end the session with a few definitions. Precision is how close the results cluster to each other. Accuracy is how close the results cluster to the truth. So a scale that is consistently off by 5 points may be very precise, but it is not accurate. Bias is a systematic error leading to a decrease in accuracy. Bias is reduced by careful studies design, as we discussed earlier. Confounding is a form of bias. It is a distortion in the degree of association between an exposure and an outcome due to a mixing of effects between the exposure and an incidental factor, which is known as the confounder. You must adjust for confounding in your study, otherwise it will lead to misinterpretation of results. The classic example is a study that was conducted in the 1950s that found a strong association between ingestion of coffee and an increased risk of pancreatic cancer. But it turned out that the investigators had not asked about a very important factor: tobacco use. Coffee drinkers were more likely to smoke cigarettes. When one adjusted for tobacco use, coffee was no longer a risk factor for pancreatic cancer. When tobacco use was not accounted for, it appeared erroneously that ingestion of coffee was associated with pancreatic cancer. In this case, ingestion of coffee confounded the association between pancreatic cancer and tobacco use. Effect modification is very different. In other words, sometimes it's referred to as interaction. Effect modification is a variable that differentially, either positively or negatively, modifies the observed effect of a risk factor on disease status. Different groups have different risk estimates when effect modification is present. Effect modification is a true phenomenon. It is not a bias. It should be reported. You do not need to adjust for it. You only need to report this true association. Here's an example. Drinking coffee is found to be strongly associated with an increased risk of HPV-induced cervical cancer. We later find out that those who drink coffee are much more likely to smoke cigarettes. Cigarette smoking, in this example, is a confounder in the relationship between coffee drinking and cervical cancer. As such, it's important to adjust for this confounder. Once you adjust for it, then you will discover the lack of an association between coffee consumption and cervical cancer risk. I thank you very much for your attention, and I hope this was useful to you, and I wish you luck on the ID board exam. Take care.